Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Stop punishing yourself with bland, chalky protein shakes and fuel your fitness with the best protein in the game at GNC. We've got the hottest brands and flavors that legit taste like cookies, your favorite cereal, indulgent desserts, and more. It's on at GNC.
Out front next, the war coming to Russia. Increased attacks on Russian territory. Putin and his forces on defense as the Kremlin vows to exterminate Ukraine. Plus, Republican Carrie Lake still obviously won't accept that she lost the race for Arizona governor, giving a keynote speaking slot at the upcoming Georgia Republican convention. Why? Well, a top Georgia election official, you know him, Gabe Sterling, who publicly rejected Trump's claims of election fraud, and bravely so, is out front. And China's brutal campaign against its own people, now at a boiling point as Chinese officials take on mosques around the country. Let's go out front. And good evening, I'm Erin Burnett. Out front tonight, the war inside Russia. There is a bold new front in the war, and it is on Putin's territory. A Russian official just this hour announcing that Russia's air defense system shot down several Ukrainian drones over Western Russia. That's just this hour, right? And then earlier today, smoke rising over Belgorod. This is new video in from there. You can see on your screen, Belgorod, of course, is the Russian city that, you know, Russia used to stage its original invasion on Ukraine, now under attack by anti-Kremlin Russian forces. Just listen to this Russian reporter on the ground describing the scene in Belgorod.
We are now spooked even by cars passing by because the town is under constant shelling. One grad shelling after another, as well as mortars, cannon artillery.
I mean, just think about how this has come, right? Russian territory, nothing was happening there, right? It was completely sacred. Now, constant attacks there. The defense ministry for Putin claiming to have taken out several dozen of the fighters who attacked Belgorod. But I want to be clear that there's no evidence of that. What is clear is that Russia is on the defense in its own country. And the head of Russia's private army, who today was seen meeting with his fighters withdrawing from Bakhmut in Ukraine, said he may soon be using his men to protect actual Russian territory. That's what Prigozhin said. And inside the Kremlin, new words, the word exterminating. They talked about exterminating Ukraine today.
It's clear what response is needed. They need to be annihilated, not just in a personal capacity, but we have to destroy them in the hornet's nest itself. The regime that is developed in Ukraine should be exterminated. It must be destroyed. Otherwise, we will face continuous threats from it.
Those threats extending to state TV tonight, where tonight one of Putin's top propagandists lashed out at the United States and its allies as well.
Just look at how you are shelling Shebekina, using your weapons with your blessing. And for that, we are going to pound you at factories that are supplying weapons to Ukraine.
I mean, those are now bald, bold, and big new threats. Sam Kiley is out front. He is live in Kharkiv tonight. And Sam, what is the very latest on the ground there tonight?
Well, people, I think, are being struck by the increasing desperate nature of the sort of smorgasbord of threats being made by the Russians against everybody who's ever supplied a weapon to Ukraine. You've got Prigozhin, the mercenary leader, saying he wants to come and start fighting or protecting Russian territory. Remember, he's been pulling out of Bakhmut at the moment, being replaced by Russian forces. But all of this is against a backdrop of the continuing campaign by Russia against Ukraine's civilians.
Grief has struck again in Kyiv. Overwhelming grief when a loved one is taken. Three people killed here in Russia's latest attack on Ukraine's capital. At 3 a.m., civilians ran for cover. The bunker was inexplicably locked. Debris from a downed missile killed two women and a child. A fatal accident in an all-too-deliberate attack. Such events are driving support for Ukraine from NATO, Europe, and beyond.
That is why every European country that borders Russia and that does not want Russia to tear it apart should be a full member of the EU and NATO. And there are only two alternatives to this, either an open war or creeping Russian occupation.
NATO's weapons are already in use in Ukraine's east. And now Ukraine has launched a campaign inside Russian territory. At least 8 people have been injured and hundreds evacuated from what are now frontline villages in Russia.
The original sin of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, compounded as it is by their continued targeting of civilians, the absolute brutality of their occupation, has ceded Ukraine an unassailable position on the moral high ground. But they've got to hold on to that even as they prosecute their own campaigns inside Russian territory.
A massive attack is ongoing. The lives of local people, primarily in Shebekino and nearby villages, are in danger.
Anti-Putin Russians in Ukraine's forces claim to have raided his province a second time and broadcast these warnings.
Stay in your homes, don't worry. Soldiers of the Russian Volunteer Corps are not at war with civilians.
They claim to have hit Russian ammunition dumps and other military targets, but Russia says the raiders were driven out with heavy casualties. Still, Ukraine now holds the initiative on this front. Russia continues to rain misery from the sky. Yaroslav lost his wife and 9-year-old daughter in this raid on Kyiv. Nothing matters anymore, he says. There are no more people left.
Now, Aaron, the scale of the hysteria inside Russia has really demonstrated how effective this relatively limited campaign from the Ukrainians and the Russians that they support from that are dissident Russians who've been crossing the borders there. But it is just about 25 minutes drive from where I'm standing. We are within missile range, and there's an anticipation that the Russians may try to strike back, frankly, and try and drive the Ukrainians back away from the border, which has been their campaign now for more than a year.
Sam, thank you very much. As you said, about 25 miles away from that border in Kharkiv. Out front now, Alma Katsu, former CIA and NSA senior intelligence analyst. She's also the author of Red London. Also with me, retired Air Force Colonel Cedric Layton. And Colonel Layton, let me just start with you, because, you know, you heard what Sam's reporting, right? This hysteria inside Russia because of this new front in the war, a front that is inside Russia. I mean, this is something that, just to be emphasized, at Colonel, even a few months ago would have been unthinkable, would have been considered an absolute red line. And now it's happened. We just had air raid sirens in Kursk near the Chernihiv part of Ukraine border, and also obviously, the smoke in Belgorod, the drone attack in Moscow this week. This is constant. What are the implications?
Well, the implications, Aaron, are actually huge. One of the key things here is that these are very limited attacks, and it would be very interesting to see the Russian reaction if the Ukrainians mounted even further attacks against the Russians and against Russian towns. In essence, what the Ukrainians have been doing is they've been giving the Russians a taste of their own medicine, and they don't really like it very much. And that's going to be, I think, a major factor in the Russian response, which could get pretty nasty, unfortunately.
Right, right. I mean, the real question is, you know, how much more can they scale up? Alma, we heard that Russian reporter, right, expressing fear. Oh, we're scared of a car driving by. Well, how about go a few miles away and go to Ukraine? But there he is in Russia feeling this way. Let me play a little bit more about what that Russian reporter said.
This is a frontline town turning into a frontline. People are leaving as Ukrainian artillery caused a real terror here. These dark plumes of smoke are everywhere.
So, Alma, he's talking about the impact on the psyche in the towns. But what does this do to Putin? How does all this impact Putin's psyche?
Well, it's probably very unnerving for him. You got to understand that he's used to being in absolute control, being seen as being in absolute control. He's kept the Russian people in a propaganda bubble. And so these types of attacks sort of undermine his narrative. He, you know, these are mostly Russian nationals who are carrying out these attacks, our understanding, with guidance from either Ukrainian special forces in the military or perhaps intelligent, but Russian nationals. So in a very public way, they're pushing back, and he's not used to that.
Yeah, I mean, this is going to be the real question of how he responds. I mean, Colonel Layton, the Russian Defense Ministry is saying 50 out of 70. Now, they're saying these were Ukrainian fighters, although Alma is right. Our understanding here is that these are Russian nationals. But the Russians are saying these are Ukrainian fighters. 50 out of 70 of them, they're saying, who attacked Belgorod were killed. Now, it's obviously impossible to know if any of these numbers have any veracity to them. They have never had honesty about their numbers, so we don't know whether there were 70 of them. We don't know who they were. We don't know how many were killed. But what do you make of this claim in and of itself?
Well, I think there's a lot of bravado attached to this claim, Aaron. And, you know, one of the key things is that, you know, as Alma correctly pointed out, you know, Putin has put these people in an amazing bubble, and the bubble is being pierced. And the fact that this bubble is being pierced is a big shock to them. So they're going to come out with these kinds of news reports, if you will, news bulletins from their side that, you know, indicate that their forces are doing something against these Ukrainian fighters. But the key element here is that I think those reports, you have to take them with a large grain of salt.
Right.
And secondly, it really speaks more to the fear that the Russians have that the Ukrainians might actually be onto something and might be actually exposing the weakness of the Russian state at this point.
Right. And certainly, you know, we saw that in Moscow, Prigozhin calling that out, right, that the drones came and the air defenses didn't stop most of it. Right. So but if these attacks continue, as there's no reason to think that they won't, there was one just in the past hour that we understand about in Kursk near the border. What does Putin do? I mean, this, as I said a few months ago, this was unthinkable. This would have been a red line. Is there such a thing at this point?
That's the million-dollar question, I think. I mean, I know a lot of us would like to see him back down or, you know, have some sort of situation where he does that. But I don't think we'd see him do that per se. You know, we have to remember that the Russian character is very macho. He can never appear to be weak. And so, you know, he said that he's committed to playing the long game now. And that would actually work in our favor. It might lead to a situation where we could find some kind of compromise, a compromise that he'd accept because it would help him save face. You know, he's indicated that he won't change from this strategy. But the thing that would force him off is if there was an attack that caused major damage, something that he could not ignore, because then if he did, he would seem weak and he would just, you know, open the door to his political rivals.
And Colonel, as a quick follow to that, you think that the Ukrainians are still pushing for what everybody at this point is still saying is a red line, although many still say go ahead and cross it anyway. And that would be Crimea itself.
Yeah, I think that's what the Ukrainians are going to do. I think these are probably feints in the direction of Russia right now. Mm-hmm. You know, anything is possible. But I think Ukraine is going to make Crimea its big target.
All right. And that really will be a true test of where all of this stands. Thank you both so very much. And next, Trump, pressed by CNN about our exclusive reporting that the special counsel has the former president on tape admitting that he kept classified material after leaving the White House, and he knew that he couldn't declassify it. What was his response? Plus, Ron DeSantis has been relentless in slamming Dr. Fauci. Relentless. I mean, it is a key part of his stump speech. But our K-File uncovered something. DeSantis used to be a Fauci fan, and we've got the tapes. And President Biden trips and falls on stage. The White House says he's fine tonight. Biden just moments ago talked to reporters about it, and we'll show you that.
Aaron Burnett Out Front, brought to you by Farsiga. Visit us at Farsiga.com for more.
Tonight, former President Trump ignoring multiple questions from our Jeff Zeleny about CNN's reporting that the special counsel has Trump on tape saying that he held on to a classified document after he left the White House and knew that he couldn't declassify it. The document was a Pentagon plan for a potential strike on Iran.
Mr. President, why did you take classified documents concerning General Milley? Mr. President, why did you take classified documents concerning General Milley? Can you talk about that, please, Mr. President? Mr. President, how do those documents get to Bedminster, sir? Mr. President, will you talk to us about the classified documents? How do those documents get to Bedminster, sir?
No answer. Well, the tape, Trump on tape talking about this, is from 2021. It includes Trump admitting that there are limits to his ability to declassify material, and that is, as I indicated, very crucial. That undercuts his main defense, right, which is that, you know, at one point he said, if I just think about it, they are declassified. Caitlin Polance is one of the reporters who broke this story for CNN, and she's out front tonight. And Caitlin, I know you've learned so much about all of this. What are you learning tonight?
Well, Aaron, this was a day of reaction, largely. A day where there was a reaction from two of Donald Trump's attorneys, one Jim Trusty last night on CNN, and then another former attorney who was involved in the defense of this case, a man named Tim Parlatore. He just spoke to Jake Tapper a few minutes ago. While Donald Trump wasn't willing to engage at all with the reporters who were asking him questions in that clip that you just played, Tim Parlatore did have quite a bit to say about his role. He also tried to downplay this idea of whether or not this document was classified, declassified, and reframe this as a question of maybe this wasn't serious national defense information. That's what the law applies to here, whether seriously sensitive documents that would be national defense information, whether they're classified or not, that doesn't matter. But if they are out of the hands of the federal government, that is what a case could be charged around, what a jury could be looking at. Mm-hmm. And so Tim did talk about that. The other thing that he talked about, Aaron, was that he talked a little bit about his searches, the role that he played. He had hired two people to do searches a full year and a half later, and they did search multiple properties. He spoke to a grand jury about what they found in those searches, and he did reiterate they didn't find anything at Bedminster at that time when the Justice Department was pressing Donald Trump and his lawyers to go back, continue looking, and see what you can find if there are any documents anywhere else. At that point in time, they did find some more in a storage unit in Florida, and obviously well after this 2021 meeting in Bedminster, the Mar-a-Lago is where all of the documents ended up that the Justice Department had recovered after that meeting. So, Aaron, there's still a lot of questions about this document that Trump is apparently referring to quite clearly on this audio recording, where it went and where it is now.
All right, Caitlin, thank you very much. And of course, as Caitlin's emphasizing, right, I mean, there were boxes and boxes and boxes of this stuff, storage rooms of this stuff. It meant some of it obviously highly classified. We're talking about one document here. So legal analyst Ryan Goodman joins me. And this one document is obviously very significant because we have Trump on tape talking about it, its existence, and his inability to declassify it, which, of course, goes against his core defense. So you heard Jeff Zeleny ask Trump repeatedly about the documents, talk about them at all. Why were they at Bedminster? You heard him do so. What do you think is the best possible explanation right now for Trump's motivation in keeping the documents?
So the CNN reporting is, in some sense, a breakthrough in this particular question. It's being the one that's in some ways hanging around that hasn't been answered. What is his motive for holding on to the documents? And here we have him, it seems like, in this situation, using them for the motive of his public image. He's trying to control the narrative. There's just been a report out that Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, stopped him from potentially attacking Iran in his final days in the office. And he says, oh, no, I've got the document that counteracts that because it shows you that Milley had this plan for an attack on Iran. That's him just trying to control the narrative and his image, and that would be a reason to hold onto the documents because he could use them in that
part. Right, to use it in that way. And, of course, just to belabor the obvious, of course, the U.S. would have those sorts of plans from many places that they don't intend on attacking. So the existence of one does not mean that there is intent to do so. I know it seems obvious, but I'm just making sure I say it.
Yes.
What about the other point Caitlin was making, though, about, you know, that they're trying to draw this distinguish, not just between classified, and at different levels of classification, but also of what is seriously sensitive and not. Do these sorts of levels matter here when we're talking about charges beyond possibly obstruction?
So it doesn't matter at one level at all. For the Espionage Act, it is just, as Caitlin said, it's just national defense information that has to be closely held.
Mm-hmm.
Trump in that conversation is also saying, I can't share this with you. he knows that it's closely held. So it satisfies those elements. Then the next question is, well, what if it is super highly classified? It actually could potentially impede the prosecutors because the U.S. intelligence community does not like to share that information or even provide it for prosecutors at a trial. So if it's a little bit, if it's below that level, if it's just secret, secret means that the unauthorized disclosure could reasonably be expected to cause serious damage to U.S. national security. Attack plans for any country as a contingency would be that. That is the Goldilocks standard, because then the intelligence community would be more likely to allow prosecutors.
So then a jury could see it, right? You could see it as opposed to this other where it's a sort of just trust us, we don't want to talk about it. Okay, so one of Trump's lawyers, Jim Trusty, he talked about this last night, and he said they're still trying to arrange a meeting, Team Trump is, with the Attorney General Merrick Garland, after sending a letter demanding one, and that they still haven't had one. Here is some of what he said.
Prosecutorial misconduct has infected this case, and we need to get it to the Attorney General directly. Before he makes any important decisions, he needs to recognize just how far afield this case has gotten.
So what do you make of what he's saying and their demand to meet with Garland himself? And Garland, at least as far as we know to this point, complete lack of response on this. What does this translate into?
I think that they think there's an indictment coming down soon-ish, and that this is their opportunity to make that last-minute meeting with the Justice Department, which is not super unusual, to get an opportunity to say, here's why you should not indict my client. But the idea that they would go to Garland now is somewhat bizarre. If we do find that there's a report of that meeting, then I do think that we're within like a 24, 48-hour period of watching to see if an indictment does drop, because they might give them that like gratuitous opportunity to present their side of the story before making that final call.
Oh, well, interesting you say if that happens, that you think it is literally 24 to 48 hours away from that decision. All right, thank you very much, Ryan. And next, Ron DeSantis has vilified Dr. Fauci, of course, again and again. But DeSantis once sang a very different tune. K-File has those tapes. And election denier Carrie Lake. She still refuses to concede. She doesn't accept that she lost the race for governor of Arizona. And she has just gotten a keynote speaking slot at the Georgia Republican Convention, which is crucial for a lot of reasons. But one of them, of course, is that Georgia took on the election lie. Election official and Republican Gabe Sterling took on those election lies day after day, and he responds next. All right, tonight, just now, President Biden making light of his fall during the graduation ceremony at the Air Force Academy this afternoon. He just spoke. Here he is. All right, obviously making a joke about it because it was a sandbag. The White House says Biden tripped over the sandbag that we will show you in the corner of the screen. See, there's a sandbag, so he's walking, trips over it as he's going back to his seat after his commencement address. The 80-year-old was seen a short time later boarding Air Force One. He was unassisted and smiling there as well. Out front now, Dr. Jonathan Reiner, who advised the White House medical team under President George W. Bush. So, doctor, I really appreciate your time. Okay, so let me just play again the video of the president when this happened. Obviously, you see him now making light of it, doing a little hop. He seems fine. He does seem to struggle to get up when it first happens, then appears to recover. You do see there is a sandbag right there in his path. That's pretty obvious. What's your reaction when you see the whole video?
Well, falls are really common, and they're especially common in the elderly. It's thought that about one out of every four people over the age of 65 will fall this year. So it's super common. This is about the third time we've seen the president fall. He fell twice going up the steps of Air Force One, once in 2021 and once earlier this year. And he has a stiff gait. And the stiff gait, which is felt to be secondary to, I think, some arthritis in his back, you know, contributes to him walking with this kind of shuffling gait. And if you hit a sandbag, there's not a lot of flexibility and you go down. And, you know, he's fine. The optics are bad. But, you know, he got unlucky and just tripped on the sandbag.
Now, we know from his physical that he is on blood thinners to treat AFib, which is obviously a fairly common heart condition. But does that specific diagnosis raise any additional concerns?
Well, when you fall and you're taking a blood thinner, it increases the risk of bleeding. And the president takes a drug called Eliquis to prevent clots from forming in his heart in the setting of atrial fibrillation. And you want to try and keep people like that from falling. And I talk to people every week the president's age about safety, about putting grab bars in their bathrooms and making sure area rugs are secure, because falls can really create a major health injury for a person the president's age, particularly if he were to break his hip.
And, you know, President Biden, you know, wasn't the only one talking about this today. President Trump heard about it, the former president, and, of course, commented on it. He had some incidents himself, which he referenced. He brought it up. Here he is.
He's at the Air Force Academy. He actually fell down. Well, I hope he wasn't hurt. But it's the whole thing is, look, the whole thing is crazy. You got to be careful about that. You got to be careful about that, because you don't want that, even if you have to tiptoe down a ramp.
When he's referencing that, of course, doctor, he's referencing himself, right? He had to walk down a ramp at West Point back in 2020. It was slippery. There was that. He had his own incidents. Actually, interesting, the way he responded there was a bit unusual for him. Perhaps to your point, one in four people fall. We're watching him here. He knows what this is like.
Yeah, President Trump was very self-conscious about that incident, and he was quite concerned about falling. Look, I would suggest to the president that he really needs to be careful. And on unsteady ground, it wouldn't be the worst thing for the president to use a cane. I know he may not like the optics, but falling appears much worse.
And one quick final question to you on that point. Does anything about this warrant the questions that, of course, we're seeing predictably in some quarters about his fitness for office?
No, not at all. Look, people have sort of this mistaken opinion that the president is like an astronaut and we're spinning them around in centrifuges to prove their fitness. But what we really ask for is mental sharpness and the ability to carry out the duties of his office. And I think the president has shown that. But the president is 80, and 80-year-old people fall. And I think the goal going forward is to prevent the president from getting hurt. And his staff should, you know, make sure there aren't obstacles like sandbags in his way.
Right, absolutely. Of course, you look in the past, people like FDR, physical ailments during presidency, JFK, right, are not unusual. Thank you.
My pleasure.
And also tonight, Republican Carrie Lake, who still hasn't accepted that she lost the 2022 Arizona governor's race, will be a keynote speaker at Georgia's upcoming Republican convention. Lake joining former President Trump as the latest election denier to accept a prominent speaking role at the Republican event. Lake, of course, still is fighting the election results from a race for governor, hasn't conceded, vowing to appeal after a judge rejected her latest legal attempt to overturn her loss. And she also continues to constantly sow doubts about the election process.
We're the laughingstock of elections here in Arizona. The system is corrupt from top to bottom. We've been playing checkers, they've been playing chess, and we're going to start, we're going to show up to a knife fight with a gun, not a knife, okay?
Up front now, Gabe Sterling, the Chief Operating Officer and Chief Financial Officer at the Georgia Secretary of State office. All right, Gabe, I'm glad to talk to you again. You know, a certain part of me is like, gosh, it's Groundhog's Day. But here we are. You're a Republican. You spent months fighting back against election lies in your state. You did audit after audit after audit. You went through every single allegation. You didn't find the fraud. So what did you think when you heard Carrie Lake was going to be, and she is now the sort of the face of election denialism in out there. She's now a keynote speaker at the Georgia Republican Convention.
Well, I mean, we went from having Vice President Pence coming to President Trump announcing he was coming to Vice President Pence saying, well, I'm going to do something else. And now Carrie Lake gets to come. So it's sort of the full cavalcade of election deniers. But we got to keep a few things in mind. The only reason Carrie Lake won the nomination for governor in Arizona was the millions and millions of dollars that Democrats who said these election deniers are dangerous put behind her because they thought she'd be the weakest candidate. And they were right. She lost the election. In Maricopa County, the entire thing, top to bottom, is run by Republicans.
Yep.
I know she doesn't like to hear that, and she says they're rhinos. They're not. They're good guys. I mean, Stephen Richer and Bill Gates do a great job.
Yeah.
They're serious about election administration. So here's the thing. You're coming to Georgia. I don't need a poll to tell me that election denialism does not work with the independent or swing voters or even a big chunk of the Republican voters in my state, because I have real life examples of where it has it. Brian Kemp, Brad Raffensperger, Chris Carr all got reelected with big majorities, Secretary Raffensperger getting the largest victory of any of them in terms of margin, based on the fact that Georgians rejected election denialism in many of these Trump endorsements.
No, they absolutely did. And yet, I mean, you know, that's why I'm trying to understand what's happening here. You know, in addition to Lake and Trump, as you point out, right, they're headliners at this. You know, Pence decided he was going to go announce his campaign. There are other Republicans scheduled to speak at this convention, right? Georgia's a crucial state now. You've got the presidential candidate, Asa Hutchinson. Obviously, to be clear, he is loud and clear. The 2020 election was not stolen. Then you've got members of Congress showing up there. Marjorie Taylor Greene, Barry Loudermilk, Andrew Clyde, Rick Allen, Mike Collins. They all say it was stolen or they voted to overturn the election results. Gabe, here's the thing. You're sitting there in the state of Georgia in this moment. Can people who have such very opposite views on something that at this point has become not just a matter of fact and fiction, right? One side is right and one side is wrong, right? One side is lying. This is not something where you can entertain two ideas at the same time. Can your party continue to be the same political party when these people are all in it?
Every party has their disparate elements that make it difficult sometimes. And you have those difficult kind of conversations. But I know what happened in Georgia is a lot of those same people who might have complained gave Brian Kemp a gigantic victory versus what he got in 2018. They gave Brad Raffensperger a gigantic victory. And they are, I view most voters as rational actors. One of the most interesting things of all was that in Marjorie Taylor Greene's district, she won that with 68% of the vote. And Brian Kemp won it with, I think, 80% of the vote, or 78%, and Brad Raffensperger won it with about 59% of the vote. So you had people who voted for Kemp, Raffensperger, and Green for very disparate reasons.
Yeah.
Now, the thing that I'm concerned about is the fact that it is 2023, so it was months I've spent fighting these things. It's been years now, let's be fair. So
yes,
the fact that this is still something people think they can build an election on, we've proven over and over again. Trump told us we'd be tired of winning. In 2018, we lost. In 2020, we lost. There are basically, we've lost Senate elections in Georgia three times based on this election denial as a touchstone. We've got to get past it. And in the past, normally, rational political players move on. President Trump has every right to run. He needs to stop talking about this election thing and start talking about the issues. Because the reality is we have Biden and Trump, who are right now the front runners. I think Biden will obviously get it. We have the two great parties nominating the only two humans who could possibly lose to each other. There's something fundamentally wrong with our overall system if that's where we're at.
All right, Gabe, thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Have a great night.
All right, you too. And next, Ron DeSantis never misses a chance to take on Dr. Fauci, right? It's a core part of his stump. But our K-File went through, looked at the tapes, listened to the tapes, and guess what? DeSantis Fauci was not always a thorn in DeSantis' side. Wait till you hear it. And mosques now being dismantled across China. It is leading to rare clashes between the faithful and police. A special report for OutFront. New tonight, Ron DeSantis's radical reversal on Dr. Fauci. CNN's K-File reporting that the Republican governor and 2024 hopeful previously sang Fauci's praises, a 180 from what he now says in nearly every public event. So here are just some examples from just the last week.
We chose freedom over Fauciism, and the state of Florida is better off as a result of doing that.
I was the leader in this country in fighting back against Fauci.
You do not empower somebody like Fauci. You bring him into the office and you tell him to pack his bags. You are fired.
Okay, right. You're saying that's right. That's right. That's what we hear him say. And you're right. But then there was this, our K-File. Andrew Kaczynski went back and he found DeSantis saying some very different things about Fauci. Here's DeSantis in March of 2020.
And you have a lot of people there who are working very, very hard, and they're not getting a lot of sleep, and they're really focusing on a big country that we have. And from Dr. Birx to Dr. Fauci to the vice president, who's worked very hard, the surgeon general, they are really doing a good job.
All right. So K-File's Andrew Kaczynski, as advertised, is now out front. So, Andrew, I just played one example of DeSantis praising Fauci, obviously, very early on in the pandemic. You found that that is far from the only time that DeSantis praised the man that he now bashes regularly.
Yeah, that's right. It's more than one example. It's actually 10 examples at least that we found in which he either cited
or praise Dr. Fauci. And what's interesting about this is he's citing him to put in place those policies early in the pandemic in Florida that he now criticizes as lockdowns. His campaign, Aaron, they've been criticizing Trump. They've been saying Trump supports lockdowns because he advocated those exact same policies at the same time as DeSantis. And this isn't some K-file hit in which, you know, the team is pulling something from 30 years ago. This was 3 years ago. We all remember Donald Trump very early on was calling in April and May to end those lockdowns.
He right. Was Easter. I remember the churches were going to be open
by
Easter.
Exactly.
Yes.
And he criticized Fauci earlier than DeSantis did, too. He was retweeting calls to fire Fauci in April. He had some of his staff over the summer had some very direct hits on Fauci. He criticized Fauci about opening schools. Take a listen to these comments from DeSantis at some of those early Florida press briefings.
The president's task force has been great. I mean, you call, you know, we've talked to Dr. Fauci a number of times, talked to, you know, the surgeon, U.S. Surgeon General a number of times, VP. You know, they've been really, really good and really, really helpful. I would defer to people like Dr. Fauci. I think Dr. Fauci has said nationwide, you're looking at 6 to 8 weeks of where we're really going to be having to dig in here.
And you say there were at least 10 of those and that he continued to do that even as Trump had turned on Fauci. So Trump turned first.
Yeah, Trump turns on Fauci pretty, I mean, it was honestly, we all remember because we were there. There was sort of the height of the pandemic, especially here in New York City. And Trump is criticizing Fauci early spring and May, right around that time.
Right. So DeSantis continues. Now, DeSantis earlier this week did say he has got he had some regrets about how he handled the pandemic. And maybe this is part of it. But here's what he said about how he handled the beginning of the pandemic.
It was a difficult situation. We didn't know a lot. And so I think people could do things that they regret. I mean, I've said there are things we did in those first few weeks that I pivoted from.
So what has the DeSantis campaign said to you about your reporting?
So we did reach out to them and they gave us a statement. And their statement was very much along the same lines as what he said. They said that like most Americans, the governor initially assumed that medical officials were going to serve the interests of the people and keep politics out of the decision. When it became clear that wasn't the case, the governor charted his own path and never looked back.
And then they say Governor DeSantis would have fired Fauci.
Yes, they did say that.
They did say that. But of course, you know, he also said what he said for months. All right. Thank you very much. Andrew Kaczynski and K-File. And next, frustrations in China boiling over as China intensifies its crackdown on its own people, now targeting mosques across the country. You'll see this first out front. And Trump taking on what has become a popular rallying cry on the right.
And I don't like the term woke because I hear woke, woke, woke.
Tonight, the defense secretary warning relations with China could, quote, quickly spiral out of control. Tensions between the two countries are at their highest in decades. China even refusing to meet with U.S. officials at a defense summit this week. Secretary Austin's warning coming as China's crackdown on its own people is rising to a frightening new level. And Ivan Watson is out front with this story you'll see first here about the Chinese government. They don't want their own people to see this. Here it is for you.
A rare confrontation between law enforcement and the faithful. Chinese Muslims clash with police outside a mosque in southwestern China. For 2 days last weekend, residents of the village of Najiying tried to protect their mosque from a Chinese government reconstruction plan. They want to demolish the roof of our mosque, an emotional local protester tells CNN, speaking on condition of anonymity. This is our last bit of dignity, the protester says. It's like someone going to your house and demolishing it. CNN reached out to Chinese authorities for comment, but the only official acknowledgement of the incident comes from this local government statement urging protesters to turn themselves in after disrupting social order and causing severe adverse impact.
Is it safe to be a Muslim in China today?
No, safe.
Ma Ju is an imam and activist from the Hui Muslim ethnic minority, living in exile in the U.S.
No Muslim is safe in China. My people, the Hui people, everyone is trembling, scared, and living in fear.
He claims the Chinese government has targeted hundreds of Hui mosques across the country. demolishing their Arabic-inspired domes and minarets and replacing them with Chinese-styled architecture. CNN has independently verified the before and after images of several of these cases, part of Chinese leader Xi Jinping's policy of Sinicization, instructing religions to basically look more Chinese.
The logic of what China's trying to do is about social re-engineering. It's by remolding people.
Academics and activists say since Xi came to power, there have been crackdowns on expressions of religious, ethnic, and linguistic identity.
Xi Jinping's policies are aimed at all socially organized groups, including Christians, Buddhists, and even some civil organizations, including LGBTQ.
CNN extensively reported on the detention of more than a million ethnic Uyghurs and other minorities in China's Xinjiang region in internment camps. And CNN reported on clashes around churches in eastern China, where authorities chopped the crosses off the top of Christian places of worship. Those scenes in 2015, remarkably similar to the images of protesters trying to protect their mosque today in Najiying. Today they'll change our mosque, tomorrow they'll ban us from going to mosques, the local protester tells CNN. A last-ditch effort to protect deeply personal concepts of faith and identity from being defined by the Chinese state. Ivan Watson, CNN, Hong Kong.
Thanks to Ivan. And coming up on AC360, an incredible rescue on Mount Everest. A Sherpa carrying a man on his back, skipping the final climb to the summit to save the man's life. And he will tell Anderson the story. That is coming up at 8. Meantime, next, Trump says he's not a fan of the term woke. Okay, but here's the question we had. How do most Americans actually view that word and what it actually means? We're going to go beyond the numbers next. Tonight, Donald Trump taking on the term woke in a campaign stop in Iowa today.
And I don't like the term woke because I hear woke, woke, woke. You know, it's like just a term that used half the people can't even define it. They don't know what it is.
Well, you know what? He's got a point there, right? If people have no idea what it is, they just have like a concept, an emotional reaction to it because it is a popular rallying cry on the right. Just this week, there were threats to boycott Chick-fil-A for, quote, going woke after the company hired a vice president of diversity, equity and inclusion, right, whose job was to, foster understanding and belonging, Christian values. Harry Enten is out front now. So, Harry, let's start with the term woke. Okay, we hear it thrown around a lot. As I said, the former president has a point. It doesn't really mean anything. It's really emotional to people.
It is emotional to people. And, you know, when people are essentially asked, if someone called you woke, how would you think of that, what they were calling you? We basically see a split country, right? We see 40% say they consider it insulting. 32% say they consider it praise. But look at that. 26% don't know the meaning. And so I think when, you know, the former president's saying that, I think he's part of that 26% who really are going, what the heck are you really talking about here, right?
Right, right, right. Is it a compliment or is it an insult? And you're right. I would presume that's very much a political, would go with political affiliation.
Yes.
Now, DEI, back to this point, right, back to the Chick-fil-A. That's diversity, equity, and inclusion. Some people obviously associate that as the ultimate corporate wokeism. And there were the calls to boycott Chick-fil-A because it actually had somebody who was a DEI officer. So how do people view DEI and how does it break down by party?
Yeah, so most American workers actually think DEI is a good thing, right? What we see is the majority of them, in fact, say it's a good thing. 56% overall who think that diversity training or DEI programs are a good thing. But among Democrats, it's 78%. Among Republicans, it's just 30%. I think that's why you're seeing all these Republicans coming out against DEI.
Quick final point. Bud Light boycott over trans in an ad. Ad sales dropped 30% for them after that. What's the swing in opinion after that?
Yeah, you know, if you essentially ask, there's a poll question, do you believe American society is too accepting of transgender people? What you see is, look at this, back in June of 2020, it's just 15%. It's up to 43% now. I believe a lot of that is being driven by the attacks on transgender people on the right side of the aisle.
That's amazing. Wow, that is a really fascinating, a huge search. Thank you very much for sharing that. That is sobering. Thanks so much to all of you for watching. It's time now for AC360 with Anderson.
When you work next level. And when you play next level. And when it's time to sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.